Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 4, Episode 24 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are doing a one-shot, our fourth look at Nicholas Meyer's career. This time we're going to be looking at his work as an Oscar-nominated screenwriter, having adapted his own book, The 7% Solution.
Yep.
So this is a book which was written by Meyer, which he then adapted himself into the movie, which was directed by Herbert Ross. It stars Nicole Williamson as Sherlock Holmes, and Robert Duvall as Watson, and Alan Arkin as Sigmund Freud. The movie was released in 1976, which was 2 years after the book. Like I said, it was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, an award which it lost to William Goldman for All the President's Men.
What are you going to do? It's William Goldman.
Yeah, I mean, come on, right? So this is a movie which is a Sherlock Holmes story in which Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud, essentially.
Sure.
We covered the book early on in our show.
Yeah.
And basically, Sherlock Holmes, being addicted to cocaine, is going to kill himself with that cocaine if he doesn't stop soon. And,
well, he's not Keith Richards.
No.
He's got a limit.
Yeah. And as a physician, Watson knows this. And he decides that the best shot at recovery for Holmes is to take him to Vienna, right?
Yes. Yeah,
take him to Vienna.
He tricks him into going into rehab.
Right.
Which always works.
It's always the best course of action, for sure.
Definitely. Never fails or backfires.
And he wants Sigmund Freud to treat him. So they set up an elaborate scenario in which he's trying to track down his arch nemesis, Moriarty, who may or may not be the evil criminal mastermind that we're led to believe he is. And he goes to Vienna, and in the process of this, he ends up going on an adventure to solve a case.
Yes,
with the help of Sigmund Freud.
It is for the most part about Holmes going to rehab.
I would say that's not true. I would say that's true of the book, but the movie definitely takes a different approach to the story.
Maybe. And, halfway into the movie that the mystery gets going.
It's slightly less than halfway into the movie.
Okay.
Which to me seems like kind of a mistake, but you know, we'll get into that in a second here. What the other thing that this movie and the book also did and does is sort of tell an alternate history to the character of Sherlock Holmes, and basically says that what was going on in the canon was not actually what happened, but instead a story which Watson wrote to explain Holmes's disappearance from the world for a stretch of time when everyone thought he was dead.
Yes. It is a very strange position that Nicholas Meyer put himself in writing Sherlock Holmes fiction in this context. And in order to make it work, he employed a very strange but perfectly reasonable approach of essentially admitting a level of fictionalization in order to make the reality more plausible. I think it actually works really well.
Yeah, and you know, in the book you have a few extra things which you can do in order to kind of sell it, because you can present it as like a document which has been found and stuff like that. Whereas in the movie, you're presenting this movie as a reality and the books, which we know as a fiction. And there's just some weird things.
Depends on where you draw the line. Exactly. Some adaptation of a book that's based on real documents.
Okay. Okay. I guess that could be what it is. So before we get into that, you know, we will compare the book to the movie. But before we do that, what are your thoughts on just the movie itself?
I think that both the book and the movie do a really good job of selling the reality, which is always sort of tricky. But I do think that in all of these cases, of all of the adaptations of all of Nicholas Meyer's Sherlock Holmes things and all of his Sherlock Holmes stories in general, I mean, essentially this is probably the weakest adaptation of anything Nicholas Meyer ever did.
Okay. Well, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean by that?
Well, like his movies, the ones that he wrote and directed that aren't this one are better. And the other works that he did that were adapted are better. I think it's largely because this movie is sort of based on a weird outlier. It is kind of about Sherlock Holmes going to rehab. And the movie adapts that faithfully, but it does have kind of an awkward time trying to figure out how to turn that into a movie.
So you think that, like, Houdini was a better adaptation than this?
Yeah. This is the only one that of his Sherlock Holmes things has been adapted into a movie, but... like, basically, this is the most awkward one. I think it's largely just because it's sort of dated, and the other works sort of shy away from those particular problems in more interesting and sometimes worse ways, but the end result is more fruitful.
Well, I mean, the fact that, I mean, if you look at his adaptations, the things that he's... made, which were based on other material. Mm-hmm. This is the only one which was ever based on his own material.
Yep.
Do you think that that had anything to do with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I think that I think that it's tricky when you're essentially turning something that you worked on for a long time into something different. And I think that in a lot of ways, I think that this really didn't need to be turned into a movie. As a book, it worked really well, and as a movie, it feels kind of weird. It's a very strange story, and it doesn't really work as an action or a thriller or any sort of other type of genre story. It's a story where a famous detective gets off of drugs,
mm-hmm.
sort of.
Okay. For me, I do like this movie. I had never seen it before up until about a half an hour ago. And I had read the book back when we covered Meyer very early on in our series,
yeah.
But I just never got around to watching the movie. And I do enjoy this movie. I think that the book is probably better, although I do think that there were a few issues in the book. While I do like it, I think that it had some weird issues in that, you know, yeah, it's a Sherlock Holmes story, so they feel the need to have a mystery, even though, like you're saying, it really is about Holmes going into rehab, and that's probably what it should focus on. I mean, they kind of justify it in that, you know, they're saying, like, look, hypnotism may not be the best permanent solution to beating cocaine, and...
or even a halfway decent one.
Or even a halfway decent one, and perhaps the thing which will help... to you know, get him on the road to recovery is to put his energy into his passion, which is solving mysteries.
Yes, he's clearly an addict, and he's got some serious psychological problems. So cultivate those.
Yeah,
or you know, just steer him away from the cocaine, because certainly chasing murderers wouldn't get him killed. Oh no, wait, it's the other way around.
So, I did like the movie, even though I do think the book is better. But there were some weird things about it. For one thing, I think that the beginning felt kind of rushed, and that the real heart of the story was sort of almost glossed over in order to get to the kind of adventure element. And I think that the mystery was simplified to a point just to get to the big action set piece at the end, which is very strange.
The action set piece where people kind of jog.
And there's a train chase.
Yeah. It's not much of a chase.
Well, I mean, see, here's the thing about it. And I think we talked about this with the book. Like, the idea of a locomotive chase is about... That's about as exciting as it sounds, which is not very exciting at all. And...
I don't know what you mean.
One train chasing another train?
Yeah.
Does that sound at all exciting to you?
It depends on which directions they're going.
Okay, let's say that they're going to the left.
They're both going to the left?
Yeah.
Sure, that would be a problem.
And that's kind of what this is.
Yeah.
And that's kind of boring. Not nearly as boring as it was when it was described on the page.
I don't know, man. I think that both of them are kind of, you know, relaxed, laid-back kind of pursuits. And I think that the locomotive chase in both the book and the movie are not nearly as awkward as the tennis scene.
I don't have a problem with the tennis scene.
Which does not work at all. Tennis does not breed any sort of excitement.
No, the tennis scene was fine, especially in the book. You know, what it did was sort of provide insight into the character of Freud, and, you know, showing him and what his strengths were as an individual and how he was going to use his intellect to beat this guy who was physically superior to him. And that plays in the movie just fine. The problem that I have with it in the movie is the same thing that I have with the... Well, one of the problems that I have with the train chase at the end is it takes up so much screen time that you're sacrificing all of these other things which are way more important to the story in order to cram this in. But when you're actually just watching the tennis match... In the movie, I think it's very interesting and cool and fun, and I liked it. And also, I like seeing how racquetball was back then, you know, or tennis or whatever you wanted to call it, indoor tennis, but it's cool.
I just call it tennis.
All right.
It doesn't matter. It's people dashing back and forth on a court, hitting a ball over a net. It's boring.
Okay. So, in relation to the book... What do you think about this movie? How do you think it compares? And
I am repeatedly frustrated by people's tolerance of poor adaptations of things, about turning one thing that's perfectly good into another thing that's not nearly as good, about thinking that things belong in every imaginable form, that somehow you can improve a thing by destroying it and making it into some other entirely different thing. This is supposed to be a book.
Mm-hmm.
That's the end.
So you don't like the movie's existence, essentially?
I think it's sort of a waste of time. I think it's sort of a waste of time. It's sort of a waste of effort. I mean, ultimately, I would have preferred if Nick Nolasmeyer had made an original movie. I don't want to see him adapt his books into another thing. I want to see him do something new.
Well, there is something to be said for that. In fact, I just heard about this the other day, which I found to be really interesting. Apparently, back before the James Bond movies were released, Ian Fleming wanted to make TV movies out of them. Yeah. Well, out of James Bond, out of the character. But instead of adapting these books, which existed, he wrote original screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to make a lot of sense. And what's kind of cool now, and I mean, we'll see, it's more cool from the historical point of view than anything else is, you know, a lot of people have been hired by the estate, the Fleming estate, to write officially licensed James Bond books.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since Fleming has died. And they just announced that they're going to be doing a new series of these books. But what's cool about this series is that they're going to be adaptations of those screenplays, which never were produced. So you're actually going to get to see, at least in some form, an original Fleming story. But this is neither here nor there. This is the most
backwards, ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Anyway, that's...
He wrote TV movies and they're adapting them into books?
Just to get the stories out, I think, okay, more than anything.
Okay, that's ridiculous.
But that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. What my point in bringing it up is that Ian Fleming saw what you were talking about, and instead of trying to cram Casino Royale onto a television screen, he decided to write a new story based on that character, which was more suited to the screen. So I could see Meyer doing that. I think in some ways that's what Time After Time is, but... the flip side of that, of course, is that it's an extremely popular book, and that's obviously what people wanted to be adapted. And I can see Meyer being like, you know what? I can make that into a good movie. Why not? So with that being said, I think that it's perfectly reasonable for him to do a movie out of his book. And I think that it is a decent adaptation. I think that one of the interesting things about it is the tone seems to be very different. Like you're saying, this is a story about Sherlock Holmes going into rehab, and that's obviously a pretty heavy story. I mean, what the concept...
I guess it's sort of played for laughs, though.
Well, in the movie, I think it is. In the book, though, I mean, I always thought it... was very sort of serious, and it's kind of like here's a guy who's known in his literature as being a adventurer, and he had this weird dark element to his character which was never really fully dealt with, and now what we're going to do is deal with it, and we'll have an adventure too, but the main thing here is that we're going to deal with the fact that he is a drug addict. And there's a certain seriousness which is present in the book, which isn't present in the movie. In the movie, it was almost like a lighthearted, fun version of Sherlock Holmes, which was, to me, way more happy-go-lucky than any of the books were, you know?
Well, it's peculiar. It's a strange scenario. It is a Sherlock Holmes story, and it seems odd, but like ultimately it is a weird thing to say that this is essentially fan fiction.
Yeah.
And it's fan fiction that is in some ways darker than the original material, which doesn't seem all that weird for fan fiction now.
No.
But at the time, it's a crazy notion of doing a dark story of a series that already pretty much always has a murder in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a strange scenario. So it makes a kind of sense that they would feel the need to make it a little bit goofy. And I think that's part of the problem. And I don't know if that's actually... I don't think that Nicholas Meyer actually intended that. I think that's just how it came out.
Maybe that's how it was directed. But, I mean, like, if you look at what he's written about the movie and listen to him talk and stuff like that, it sounds like he's pretty satisfied with the finished product.
I don't think that it's a failure of any kind. I just think that it's sort of a shame that we don't have the freedom to do what should be done.
You know, it was kind of funny in a sense looking at this movie. There's a lot of people who have a lot of Sherlockians, or what are they called?
I call them Sherlocksmiths.
Okay.
They call themselves Sherlockians.
Do they? Okay.
Which I find to be a great waste of an opportunity.
Okay. Well, those people, a lot of them have been rather critical of the Robert Downey Jr. stars, the Guy Ritchie movies, for being, you know, basically big action movies, you know, sort of like the Pirates of the Caribbean versions of Sherlock Holmes. And watching this, I kind of see the same thing. I mean, the action set pieces aren't as big, but I mean, this movie does have a scene where completely logical Sherlock Holmes has the villain at gunpoint, and because the villain kind of eggs him on, he decides to drop the gun in favor of having a sword fight with him.
Yeah.
That doesn't make a lot of sense at all. You know, That's a lot less logical than what you would find in the Guy Ritchie movies.
I don't know, man. I mean, like, I don't think that's even all that illogical or even all that out of character for Sherlock Holmes. I mean, even while he was in some ways sort of clinical and almost robotic, he was also still fairly regularly saddled with the burden of being gentlemanly.
Yeah. But
he did sort of follow the rules.
But is this really a rule that he needed to follow? I mean,
I think he did.
Okay. I don't know. It just seemed weird. And also the, like we were talking about, you know, the kind of tendency to emphasize the action elements in the movie.
Yeah.
Instead of the story elements or the character elements that were present in the book really makes me think that there are some pretty strong parallels between this and the Guy Ritchie movies.
I can see that. I don't think that the Guy Ritchie movies are particularly inaccurate.
Blown up a bit.
Yeah, and I think that the criticism of those movies is not that they are inaccurate portrayals of Sherlock Holmes, that they're somehow like portrayals of the character or the genre. I think they're just signs of the times. It doesn't reflect very poorly on the way Sherlock Holmes has been treating so much as it reflects poorly on the way Hollywood works now.
Yeah. And I do like those movies to some extent. I mean, I like the first one a lot, and the second one I think is decent. But, you know, I mean, you compare them to, like, the series with Jeremy Brett, you know, which is, like, slavishly true to the canon, and it doesn't work as well, you know, it just doesn't.
Okay. Okay, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people who've played Sherlock Holmes over the years, and I think they've all done a pretty good job. I mean, like, ultimately, I think that the shocking and sort of strange thing about it is that the new Sherlock series is unbelievably, bizarrely accurate to the books, despite being radically different in almost every imaginable way. It's present day. There are computers, and he's good with software. It's all kinds of bizarre, but it's dead on. It is dead on. It's strange how flexible the character and the setting is, considering you can do that. And I think ultimately that is the most damning indictment of the Robert Downey Jr. movies, that they picked the wrong things to be faithful to.
Oh, that could be. I still haven't seen Sherlock. I know I need to, but, you know, I've got other things I'm watching too, you know? There's only so many hours in the day.
I know, but there are only, like, six of them.
But they're all, like, 2 hours long.
Like an hour and a half.
So, as far as Trek collaborators in this movie, there's only one that I noticed, and that's Joel Grey, who, he's only been in one episode of Star Trek, hasn't he?
Don't know what you're talking about.
He's the guy, in this movie, he's the guy who they spot who's following them, and then, like, he's the guy who's hired to get the woman back onto cocaine, so...
Yeah.
They're following him, and then they, like, capture him or whatever and take him back to their place, and then they're talking about him and not paying attention to him, and he sneaks out the door, and then they grab him again, and then he reveals what the plan is, and then that's when they get onto their train chase. That dude.
Okay.
He's in The Player as himself. At one point, Tim Robbins goes up to him and says, "Hey, how's it going?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm doing okay. I have that tie."
What?
Yeah, it's just the scene. That's what he does in the movie.
Okay.
Anyway, he was in an episode of Voyager called Resistance, where he played a guy named Calum, who thought that Janeway was his daughter.
What?
I don't remember this episode exactly.
I have no idea what that is.
I thought he had a bigger role because, I mean, he's at conventions and stuff all the time. There was this whole thing at the Vegas convention that I was at a couple of years ago where they did a panel with Shatner and Mulgrew together. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Joel Grey just shows up. and like crashes the panel, and then it becomes like Kate Mulgrew, William Shatner, and Joel Grey. And it's like Joel Grey is like a big name in acting circles. I mean, he really is.
I'll just say, you know, I was wrong. There are definitely three.
Oh, okay. So there's like nine episodes.
Yeah. They're not long, though.
Okay. But I just assumed that he had been in more stuff. I assumed that maybe he played like a Q or something like that. But no. So anyway, he's in it. He's a good actor. He's, you know, he won the Oscar for Cabaret, and I think that's his big claim to fame. But
well, that's not nice. He was in this movie.
I've never seen Cabaret, but
that's good.
Okay. But anyway. Well, do you have any final thoughts on the 7% solution?
Years before I saw this movie, for many years actually, I was really curious about what the title was in reference to. And then I found out, and I thought, wow, that's super weird.
Yeah, and they briefly touch on it here. They deal with it more in the book. Here, they're just like, he always had that 7% solution. You know? Yeah.
It's not like a solution to a problem that involves the very key quotient of 7%.
Well, but it's a double meaning, right?
Sort of.
It's a 7% solution of cocaine, but it's also the solution to the problem of... Yeah, anyway. Okay.
Well, it's not really the same thing as using the word solution in the context you expect it to. I mean, it's a mystery. It's got Sherlock Holmes in it. And it's not the solution to a mystery or a problem in the story.
Yeah.
It's a very strange title.
Yeah.
And when you read the book and you see the movie, it's sort of obvious that the title and everything about it is about Sherlock Holmes and rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And the mystery is really weirdly present. Because it doesn't really need to be there.
So, I mean, just discussing Sherlock Holmes, you know, we've got Sherlock, which stars Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
A Star Trek alum, obviously.
Well, a Sherlock alum.
Oh, he's both, right? We've also got Elementary, which has a number of Star Trek people associated with it. For one thing, you've got Robert Doherty. He's the showrunner, I believe, right?
On Elementary?
On Elementary. And he has worked on Voyager as a writer, which is kind of cool. He wrote 15 episodes of the show, including Endgame, the very last episode. So he's running Elementary, and you've also got Robert Hewitt Wolfe, who's a staff writer, so that's cool. And then we have one more Sherlock Holmes thing, which is going to be coming out relatively soon, and that's called Mr. Holmes, which is a movie about an old retired Sherlock Holmes played by Ian McKellen, which is kind of cool. It's going to be directed by Bill Condon, which is cool. And it could be interesting. Yeah.
It's sort of odd that Ian McKellen has not played Sherlock Holmes yet, considering how much he looks like him.
Yeah. I don't know what Sherlock Holmes looks like, but...
He's always described as being very gaunt, very tall.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
And, you know, British.
Yeah, I guess he's that, too.
He's got the main three, the big three.
Yeah. So that's something which is coming out next year, so look for it. It should be cool. For my final thoughts on the 7% solution, I guess I would just say that it is a good movie. It's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination. I do think it's not as good as the book, but I think that it does offer a few things that are missing from the book. Mainly a sort of light, fun humor, which, while maybe isn't the best choice for this story, is an interesting thing to see. All right, before we go, I just thought we would touch on sort of a follow-up to our Houdini discussion. I can't remember whether or not we actually talked about this, but...
We didn't.
Okay, well, we'll bring it up.
I don't know what it is.
In our Houdini episode, I did mention briefly that it felt like this was a re-edit of a more classically styled form of television movie.
Yeah, you did present the question, like, do you think that there was an original version?
Right.
And I said something along the lines of, maybe, but, like, it doesn't seem way off because it is sort of about the guy and yeah. all of the weird, annoying MTV-style editing things seem to be about his psychology.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not re-edited?
Right. Well, it turns out that it was re-edited. There have been a series of interviews recently with Nicholas Meyer, some of them in promoting Houdini and some of them in regards to his recent appearance at the Star Trek convention in London. And in those interviews, he has talked about how the version which they turned in, he calls it the Lionsgate version, which appeared over in Europe, was, I think, originally longer, and also it lacked the voiceover. And there mm-hmm. were, I think, a few other things. And he said that, you know, basically, when the History Channel got it, they were like, this isn't going to play well for American audiences, so we better dumb it down a little bit. And he said that he's happy with the Lionsgate version, but he does not like the History Channel version.
People are always adding voiceover to dumb things down.
Luckily for us, the movie did just come out on Blu-ray, and it would appear to be that original version. So for those people who are interested in seeing what the original cut of Houdini was, or for those people who haven't seen it and want to see it in its original state, then you're in luck. One other thing to note about Houdini, which I thought was kind of interesting, which, you know, showed up in one of these interviews, is, you know, he talked about how, you know, this is adapted from his dad's book and everything yeah. like that, and how when he was approached to do it, I think by Gerald Abrams, JJ's dad, you know, he said, yeah, I'll do it, but I've been wanting for years to adapt my dad's book, and no one wants to just pay the rights fees for it, which is like $1,500 or something like that, you know, so if you do that, then I'll do it. And he said that it was always intended to be like a two-night event, and he wanted it to be called, the first part to be called Becoming Houdini, and the second part to be called Being Houdini. And, you know, the studio or whoever was like, that's dumb. But he did say that the split and everything and the way that it's structured was maintained. That was his original version.
Should have been called Houdini Begins.
Yes.
And Houdini Rises.
Yes. But anyway, so that's kind of an interesting little bit. And then the other thing which I thought was kind of interesting in regards to all of this is that he was asked about how he didn't direct it, how someone else was directing it. And the person who they hired to direct it was someone who he was happy with and someone whose, you know, material he thought gelled with him. And in the end, he was happy with the finished product, although when asked if he was there on set, he said that he was on set for part of it, and he was talked into leaving, and he wished he would have stayed. And I thought, boy, like when he said that, I'm like, is he basically saying that they messed this up? But then when people ask him about the, you know, what he thought about the direction, he was like, oh, no, it's good. So I'm curious as to what he means by that. It's interesting. And one more thing about Nicholas Meyer, which is probably of significance to the 7% solution and what we're talking about here and everything, is that he is currently working on a Sigmund Freud television series along with Frank Spotnitz of yeah. X-Files fame.
I'm looking forward to the episode where Sherlock Holmes shows up for good rehab.
That would be awesome
and
if
they
did that.
And then they play tennis.
That would be cool. Oh, man,
they
got to do that.
45 minutes.
He said that he's writing the first two episodes and he may direct one of them, so
that'd be cool. I'm hoping it's animated.
It would be excellent. We shall see. Well, it's been fun talking about the 7% solution today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Also, I never know whether it's pronounced Babel or Babel, so I always feel scared to talk about it.
That you don't want to bring it up in polite conversation.
Yeah. Journey to Boon, you know.
You know, journey to journey.
Yeah.
Journey to the center
to,
of the Earth.
To the journey, yes.
Earl Grey.
Patrick Stewart said, look, we can have that scene where Worf explains why he's in the movie, or we can have my Mambo scene, but we can't have both. So.
The Orb.
He just completely sells it, and he is Benjamin Sisko by this point. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Well, he better be Benjamin Sisko by this point, yeah. Matthew. There's only one episode left in the series.
This is true.
To the journey!
And this is, I would dare even say, when he starts falling in love with Captain Janeway. This is the road that leads to the bathtub. From this point forward, he is just ever so slowly falling for her. And the monkey.
Warp 5.
They were just like, okay, we know this is the end. So screw it. We're just going to do whatever the hell we want. And putting Shatner in there, it's just like, why not? Who cares?
The Ready Room.
Also, one other thing it reminded me of, when they're in space, the escape pod that Trip and Kaitama use, did that not look to you guys like the ship from Pigs in Space without the engines?
Yes. Oh my gosh. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
There are two notes that I seriously made. There were two notes that I made.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, I love Riker's TV. I question what he's watching.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Robert Wise, if he's on the bridge of the Voyager, he's not even back at Harry Kim's station, right? He's one of the extras in the background who has to stand because he doesn't even have a chair.
Literary Treks.
You're waiting for one of the core cast of Vanguard to show up in these books, you're going to be waiting a long time. As long as the three of us have anything to say about it, it ain't going to happen.
Continuing mission.
The big thing here is I did it all for the cost of 3DS Max, which I bought with an educational discount. So like $300.
I don't think you can get an educational discount on materials to build an actual set, can you?
Axanar, the official podcast.
When I learned the concept behind Prelude to Axanar that was going to be a History Channel style documentary, I got so excited. Like, my favorite Star Trek book ever is David Goodman's Federation, the First 150 Years, because I just love, it's a history book.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for our other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. One way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll all join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Like we said last week, the reason why we're doing 7% solution is because that's what our Patreons suggested we do. And we are going to do an audio commentary for this movie. So if you are a Patreon subscriber, and you contribute at that level, which isn't a lot, I think it's like $2 or $3 a month, then you can hear us talk about the 7% solution in great detail in a couple weeks. You can contact us any number of ways. You can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at comtrackstars. And you can also find us on our website, commentarytrackstars.com, where we do commentary Trackstars off topic with our friend Brandon. You can also contact us on Trek.fm. Just go to Trek.fm/contact. You can leave a voicemail. Just look on the sidebar of the show page, and you can click the little button and then leave us a message. You can also contact us or as a network on Twitter at Trek.fm. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/TrekFM, where you'll find the Babel Conference. Type in the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and you'll find that there. It's a little forum kind of thing, and we can let you in. It's a closed forum, but we'll let you in if you ask. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, where else? I mean, I guess I could give you like our home address or something, but that's not a good idea. No. All right. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our other shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for supporting Trek FM and commentary Trek Stars. And you can even find the 7% solution on there. So go check it out. All right, well, that's it for our fourth look at Nicholas Meyer. Yep. And we will be back next week with Matt from the Delta Quadrant and the Nerd Party to discuss David Mack and his work on Deep Space Nine.